The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
The papers appear in the conference. Barbara Epstein is first, and she will be talking about the rise, decline, and hopeful revival of socialist humanism. Then I'm going next. My name is Živka Volevičarska. I'm speaking about Marxist humanism and the rise of ethno-nationalism in post-Stalinist Eastern Europe. Then our colleague Nikolai Kirkov, who is speaking, his paper is called Beyond Humanitas Towards Anthropos on the Limits of Marxist Humanism in Eastern Europe. And finally, Kevin Anderson, whose paper is titled From Humanism to Althusser and Back. Thank you.
Okay. And could somebody keep an eye on time, because we each have only 15 minutes, okay. And it would be a good idea to be, where should I put this?
Maybe close to you, and if you want, I can keep
the
time for you
also,
Barbara.
Okay.
So when you have 5 minutes, I'm just going to give you 5 minutes.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, what I'm going to try to do at top speed in the amount of time we have is talk about why socialist humanism took hold, particularly in peace movements, in Britain especially, also the United States, and to some extent the broader left, in the late 50s up to the mid 60s. I'm going to say very briefly what it was, but in a way I'm leaving that to others who are going to talk more about the theorists than I am. And then I'm trying to give you my my idea of why it got forgotten about by the left. And that's really why I began this project. I wanted to try to understand why these ideas had been pushed aside. First of all, socialist humanism was developed in the to some extent in the 1930s, particularly in the 1940s, and especially in the 50s. The turning point being the 1956 speech by Khrushchev denouncing Stalin, which gave people in leaving communist parties in many places the hope that it might be possible. Perhaps for the Soviet Union to move towards a more humanist version of socialism. But if not that, at least there was the hope that a more humanist version of socialism might become the dominant form in the international left. Socialist humanism was probably the dominant intellectual current within the British New Left. Of the very late 50s and early 60s. It was a current within national liberation movements in Africa. And I would say it was a kind of undercurrent in peace movements in the United States. And in those movements, we didn't talk about socialism very much. It was considered too dangerous. This was the tail end of McCarthyism. But when, in my experience, when people talked about what their politics were and what their vision was for a better society, it accorded with socialist humanism. So the question is, what is or was socialist humanism? The meaning of socialism, I think, is pretty clear. Socialists favor a society based on cooperation and the common good, not on competition and the pursuit of private profit. The meaning of humanism is less clear. The term has been attached to a range of meanings, some of them derogatory. What the socialist humanists of the middle decades of the 20th century meant by it was, first of all, a conviction that while social structures shape the choices that are available to us, social change is brought about by the decisions and actions of individuals working collectively. Secondly, the term meant to them a vision of a socialist society that would promote individual creativity as well as social social solidarity. In other words, not just a good welfare system and education and so forth, but also democracy, and democracy meaning extensive participation in political decisions and the right to dissent. So from the beginning, it was a conception of socialism that was critical of the kind of socialism that was taking place in the Soviet Union. Socialist humanism is based on the writings of Marx, particularly Marx's concept of alienation in the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts. And it was, by the way, the discovery of that manuscript in Moscow, and then its translation, first into, from the German, then into French, and then into English, that spurred the development of socialist humanism as an actual academic discussion. Well, it is unfortunately necessary also to say what socialist humanism is not. It is not a campaign on behalf of a secular viewpoint, or an effort to bring religious people over to secular views. Now, it is true that the great majority of socialist humanist theorists have been secular. But it is also true that there have been religious thinkers. The two who are most prominent are Martin Buber and Paul Tillich, who were, in Buber's case, a religious Jew, and in Tillich's case, a Christian, who were socialist humanists. And Eric Fromm, who was the person who insisted on using the term socialist humanism rather than Marxist humanism, did so largely because he wanted to make sure that he could include people who were not Marxists. And that, for instance, meant Buber, who objected to Marx's attack on utopian thinking and therefore would never call himself a Marxist, even though he very much appreciated Marx's class analysis and his concept of alienation. The term socialist humanism is sometimes used in a derogatory sense to describe those with a naively sunny view of humanity. There are those who claim that it means that human beings are perfectible, humans can do only good, and so forth. The fact of the matter is, I do not know of any Marxist or socialist humanists who said such a thing. It's about the possibility of human collectivity and human behavior. It's not a view that everybody is wonderful and that's the solution to all problems. Now, it is true that socialist humanists and Marxist humanists, I take the term socialist humanist to include Marxist humanists, did believe that there is such a thing as human nature, though human nature is much more malleable, apparently, than the nature of other animals, there are nevertheless such things as human characteristics, human capabilities, human needs, and so forth. And therefore, you can talk about humans having a particular range of characteristics. They believed that humans require social cooperation and support, that they are capable of individual creativity and collective action, and also of empathy and rational thought. But the crucial word here is capable of all of these things. They also believed that humans are most likely to thrive in the context of egalitarian communities dedicated to the common welfare. And finally, socialist humanism was not in itself about the welfare of other animals or of the planet, but it is. It doesn't exclude those possibilities. And in the rise of anti-humanism, one of the accusations of socialist humanism was that it's somehow anti-environmental, anti-animal rights. It places humans at the center. Before 1956, socialist humanism was more or less a trickle in intellectual life. But the events of 1956 opened up enormous interest in socialist humanism. Many left intellectuals and activists believed that the Cold War was coming to an end, and that this opened up the possibility of revolutions or at least fundamental change on both sides of the Iron Curtain. E.P. Thompson, in particular, believed that there would be movements for a humanist form of socialism both in the United States, in the West as a whole, and also in the Soviet Union. He was to some extent right about the West. It certainly was happening in Britain and to a lesser extent there in the United States. He was unfortunately not really right about the Soviet Union. I think I'm going to skip. I was going to talk in more detail about the views of socialist humanists. But since I have...
5 minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes. Okay, then I will say very briefly that... what socialist humanists have focused on is, first of all, the idea that the future is open. What that means is that human decisions and human action, human collective action, even though they take place in the context of class and other structures, are nevertheless decisive. And we can't tell what's going to happen. It's possible that, as they said then, the working class will never become the universal class and we will not have socialism. On the other hand, it's possible that that or something like it will happen. Another focus of socialist humanists, particularly in the late 50s and early 60s, was the importance of utopian thinking. Kolakowski, for instance, who was a dissident Polish Marxist who wrote about, so identified himself with Marxist humanism in the late 50s, wrote that the left defines itself not only by what it is against, but also by what it is for. And he said the importance of utopian thinking is that it describes goals that are unattainable now that may never be reached unless they are articulated while they are still unattainable. And he also argued that while a utopian vision on the part of an individual or a small group of individuals may disappear without a trace, he said that a utopian vision, once taken up by a mass movement, acquires a certain reality and colors the actions of those movements. Then the last thing I want to say, which I will try to say in 2 minutes, is the question of why did this hopeful vision disappear from the vocabulary of the left after, say, in the latter part of the 60s, and really was gone by the early 70s. My theory is that it was fed by the peace movements of the late 50s and early 60s, and by the question of peaceful coexistence. The peace movements were in favor of peaceful coexistence, and that was consonant with the views of socialist humanists. The Vietnam War, the Sino-Soviet split, and the Chinese and Third World challenge to the Soviet Union as the leader of the communist world all switched the discussion in another direction. What that did was to make American imperialism and the anti-imperialist movements of the Third World the focus. In that context, it was difficult to talk about peaceful coexistence. And of course, the Chinese were opposed to peaceful coexistence. The movement as a whole in the United States, the anti-war movement, was very difficult to find anybody who had much sympathy for the Soviet Union. And it was not difficult at all to find lots of people who regarded China and other third world revolutionary societies as models. It was also a period when, because when third world revolutions were regarded as models by many people on the left, that meant armed insurrection, and so there was a shift from a an orientation towards nonviolence and nonviolent direct action towards a discussion of seizing the state, picking up the gun, armed struggle, and so forth. And all of this made, and on top of that, there was an attack on liberalism. Liberalism and liberals were at least rhetorically seen as the main enemy. This was understandable at the time with people who described themselves as liberals running the war in Vietnam. But nevertheless, and there were people in the left who said they're different kinds of liberals, but nevertheless the rhetoric became that the split was between the liberals and the revolutionaries. And so socialist humanism began to look like a sort of warmed over version of liberalism. And therefore, I would say, slipped out of the vocabulary, certainly of the radicals who were at the center of the movement. Now, the last thing I will say is that I think we are now in a different moment. I think we are in a moment that calls for a popular front. It calls for an inclusive movement of not only socialists and revolutionaries, but also progressives and liberals, of anybody who is opposed to authoritarianism and to racism. And I think that in the context of that kind of moment, and also I think this is now a moment when, you know, really there is no revolutionary armed struggle in the rest of the world that American leftists are likely to look to for direction. And so I think it's possible for some of the themes of socialist humanism to become prominent again.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara, for this wonderful introduction. And I'm going to pick up from where you, you know, left and gave us this beautiful introductory sort of survey of socialist and Marxist humanism. And I'm going to take everybody to Eastern Europe and what happened on the East European side of things during the post-Stalinist era. And so Marxist humanism, as Barbara said, began to take shape in the late 1950s, in the same way as emerged in Western Europe. I'm looking at it from the East European side, and how it took shape immediately after, or in the late 50s, in opposition to Stalinism, mobilizing movements against authoritarianism and bureaucracy. So we have a very, very robust intellectual and political life around the revival of the humanist ideas, and especially the early works of Marx, as a contribution to Marxist historiography, leading anti-Stalinist Marxists in the socialist countries in Eastern Europe recovered and published the early works of Marx, which had been marginalized during the formation of the Marxist-Leninist canon, aiming to liberate Marx's thought from the fixed and historical renditions of the Stalinist doctrine. In the Soviet Union, we have some marvelous humanist scholars of Marx from the late 50s to the 1980s, some of which, very few of which have been translated in English. We have one translation by Eval Ilyenkov on Lenin, like a post-Stalinist kind of reinterpretation of Lenin, but pretty much everything else hasn't been very much translated. We have Merab Mamardashvili, Nikolai Lapin, Georgi Bagaturia, and many others. We have also the kind of an older generation philosopher called Theodor Oyserman, who sort of educated and trained the following generation of humanist thinkers. So they were all involved in transcribing and translating and republishing the entire corpus of Marx's work, including the 1844 manuscripts, which came out in Russian in 1956. A little volume called Из ранних произведений. a very important book, which kind of circulated very widely. And if you go to any East European library and try and check out this book, it's going to be either missing or really kind of you'll see the marks and how it's like really worn out from a lot of use. In Czechoslovakia, we had Karel Kosik and Robert Kalivod. There's a strong humanist tradition in Hungary that needs no mention here. In Yugoslavia, we have the Praxis School of Thought, which Nikolai Turkov is going to talk about, and so on. Among the central categories of Marxist humanist thought, as Barbara sort of briefly went over, were dialectical totality, alienation, reification, and praxis. I'm sure these are familiar, which the Stalinist canon had expelled from its conceptual apparatus. And most importantly, man and the human emerged as a new political subject and an agent of struggle. Human liberation, human freedom, and human agency became central organizing problems in much of anti- and post-Stalinist Marxist humanism, and the assertion that, quote-unquote, men are creators of their own history found reverberations among the anti-Stalinist left across geopolitical divides and continents to mobilize anti-capitalist, and not only anti-capitalist, but some anti-colonial and also some feminist liberation movements. But as much as this new subject became the foundation for new and radical visions for liberation, it also laid the grounds for reactionary political developments. European humanism produced its own hegemonic notions of the human that were ethnocentric, nationalist, and patriarchal. And these notions also remained blind to the colonial premises of European knowledge. And I call this dominant or hegemonic humanism. And of course, there are competing definitions of the human coming from the anti-colonial liberation thinkers and later from the decolonial traditions, which made humanist thought from the 60s and the 70s much more complex. Marxist humanism was also present in the women's liberation movements and the struggles against racism across the United States. In short, there's much diversity and many alternatives and antagonisms within this kind of larger humanist post-Stalinist or anti and post-Stalinist turn make the era of humanism extremely complex and interesting, and so it's certainly not a singular historical phenomenon, or it certainly doesn't have kind of a singular political logic. And here I want to come to explore some of the political operations of the hegemonic tendencies within the humanist turn in the context of the post-Stalinist period in Eastern Europe. And so I argue, my argument is very briefly, that throughout Eastern Europe, Marxist humanism, again, in its hegemonic formulations, opened the conditions for the rise of ethno-nationalism. And that link between humanism and ethno-nationalism I'm tracing in the work of the East European humanists. It made possible the rise of ethno-nationalism in the 60s and the 70s, and this opening or this possibility was contained in the epistemic logics of Marxist humanist thought. And so we know how, for example, ethnic conflict, right, in the Balkans in the 90s, right, the emergence of all that ethnic war and conflict in the 90s, and how it's often attributed to the presence of some kind of latent nationalist tendencies that preexisted the socialist era or even the modern period in some very orientalizing way. But in fact, anti-Stalinist political discourse from the 60s and the 70s actively mobilized the idea of the ethnos within a Marxist humanist framework. Mm-hmm. And it invented or reinvented the idea of the ethnos and the idea of the nation, and in that way sort of produced the ethno-national turn. In the former Yugoslavia, some of the most prominent humanist philosophers welcome the idea of Greater Serbia. And here I'm going to focus on post-Stalinist socialist Bulgaria and how the Marxist humanist political project deployed an ethno-nationalist discourse and embraced the idea of ethnic homogeneity, which shaped the assimilationist politics of the post-Stalinist government. the assimilationist turn in post-Stalinist Bulgaria, which, as I said, has parallels in other countries in Southeastern Europe and in Eastern Europe, culminated in the so-called revival process during the 1980s. The revival process, Възродителен процес in Bulgarian, represents a violent political turn in the history of late Bulgarian socialism. It was a campaign of ethnic and cultural assimilation of Turkish, Bulgarian Muslim, or Bulgarian-speaking Muslim and Romani, and also actually Macedonian people earlier in the 1960s. It forcibly renamed hundreds of thousands of people with Muslim and Turco-Arabic names, and took a wide range of measures towards the erasure of their culture, faith, ritual, language, and history. By the summer of 1989, after a decade of demonstrations and unrest, the revival process had escalated to the expulsion of several hundred thousand Turkish people and some Pomaks, or Bulgarian-speaking Muslims, into neighboring Turkey. Born and raised for generations and actually centuries in Bulgaria, in what is now the Bulgarian nation state, hundreds of thousands of people were uprooted from their homes and exiled into Turkey and were forced to seek political asylum from what was in practice the biggest ethnic purge in the history or in the modern history of the country. Mm-hmm. As the grueling details of the revival process continue to emerge, the majority of existing research had underscored continuities with earlier waves of ethnic assimilations and expulsions, and there were also population swaps or population exchanges as part of nation-state formation in the Balkans during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But I argue that the historical developments from the 60s to the end of the 80s present a kind of specificity. I have been studying very closely the post-Stalinist doctrine of ethno-nationalism, and I show how it was nested in the conceptual premises of Marxist humanist ideas of peoplehood, freedom, social emancipation, democracy, and social integration. Also, there was a concept, the holistically developed person, a leading concept in East European Marxist humanism, which was central to the ethno-national idea. It was taken from the early Marx, which is in English usually translated as the all-rounded individual. But the holistically developed person, or сестранно развитата личност, how in Bulgarian, in Russian, it's very similar in Russian, and so that was a kind of socialist humanist subject which organized the political imaginary and became a foundation for a great number of really interesting changes. And this subject sort of became a measure of social relations at large. And a micro-universe of sorts as a reflection of the totality of social relations. The humanist political imaginaries around social integration, social mobility, and democracy, as reflected through the holistically developed person, contained a strong discourse of unity and cohesion. And so national oneness and ethnic homogeneity, the nation's monolithic ethnic unity, became the foundation of a developed socialist society and an expression of the social totality and the full social mobility had promised. And democratic and free access to education, culture, leisure, healthcare, and so on. So post-Stalinist ideas of ethnic monism and ethnic homogeneity became structurally tied to these socialist humanist notions of state governance and their totalizing ambitions. And this is why the doctrine saw non-Bulgarian ethnic communities as dividing the unity of the people, of the Bulgarian people. And the revival process was an attempt to integrate the population into a unified whole and to restore and strengthen its integrity. The doctrine of ethno-nationalism also adopted earlier concepts of nationhood and reinvented them in the context of what was seen as developed socialist relations. And this is how the post-Stalinist period referred to itself, developed socialist relations. It reimagined socialism through a sort of national revolutionary history, autonomous from Soviet history. And I think that's also very important. In some sense, humanist thinkers in Eastern Europe and the Balkans turned to nationalism as a kind of cultural emancipation from Soviet hegemony and as a resistance to it. Mm-hmm. So nationalist discourse was in a sense both an anti-Stalinist and an anti-Soviet discourse. It gave humanists the opportunity to displace Soviet-centric histories of socialist revolution as a world historical phenomenon, and to trace the internal genealogy of revolutionary traditions in the struggles of its own people. So in other words, nationalist humanism rewrote and re-anchored the world historical revolutionary narrative by staging a competing narrative and by bypassing the February and October revolutions. So February and October was this Marxist-Leninist thing, and we're not following this dogma. We have our own revolutionary traditions. But also, in order to be a socialist history, national history had to be a people's history and a revolutionary history, one that was grounded in the stories of oppression and collective struggle. So it had to be very different from the nationalism from the pre-socialist era, which they called bourgeois chauvinism. I've been also studying the work of Lyudmila Zhivkova, who was a leading figure that shaped the cultural politics of the country. And she argued that the national narrative had to be purged of, I'm quoting, exploiters, murderers of feudal lords and tsars and monarchs, of bourgeois oppressors. It had to be cleared of bourgeois individualism and chauvinism. And so the national struggle had to construct the continuity of endurance and suffering and struggle of the ordinary people and the oppressed that culminated in the socialist present. And it was a present that had no precedent in history because it brought liberation and democracy and material and cultural wealth to the ordinary people. The narrative also established a historical account which saw the renaming campaign of the 80s as a continuation of the unfinished liberation of the Bulgarian people from Ottoman rule. It was seen as a progressive, revolutionary historical movement, part of building developed socialist relations. The Ottoman past was imagined as backward and frozen in time, the historical agent of patriarchal relations, of what was seen as cultural traditionalism and religious fanaticism. Seen through this lens, Muslim and ethnic minorities and their cultures became a remnant of the past, a kind of social and cultural anachronism which socialist modernization was to overcome. In this sense, discourses of socialist modernization, progress, and development became a central element in the emerging doctrine of ethno-nationalism. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm just going to say a few words in conclusion. After this sort of brief analysis of post-Stalinist ethno-nationalism and its links to Marxist humanism in Eastern Europe and the East European context, I'm interested in this kind of critical historical reading of the humanist turn and the way it shaped the political era of the 60s and the 70s. And I think, like by Barbara, we cannot understand the 60s and the 70s, especially the shift from Stalinism to post-Stalinism in Eastern Europe, but also more globally, without turning to kind of the rise of humanism, insofar as it was kind of a movement against orthodox Marxist thought and also certain forms of political organizing, right? And in some way, the construction of the 60s as a global political era was possible mainly through the rise of Marxist humanism. And I also think we need to account for the inherent contradictions in this humanist thought if we and have to take into account the reactionary historical developments, as is the case of the histories of ethno-nationalism in the Balkans, and how these legacies are continued in the post-socialist context and in post-socialist politics. The spectrum of forces that unfolded in Eastern Europe after 1989, and that's not only the unchallenged privatization of public infrastructure, but also the rise of neo-fascism and the consolidation of a very strong nationalist front that's emerging from mostly from the right, but also practically there's no opposition from the liberals, and that particularly difficult legacies poses very extremely difficult challenges for the left, the post-socialist left, that we're confronted with. Thank you.
see if I can do this from here. I do have some slides in case people get a little distracted or bored. You don't have to look at me. Let's see if I can just show. So I want to begin with a few preliminary comments, quick ones. Also coming as somebody who has a training in philosophy, even though a very weird kind of philosophy. The market in critical theory books these days, you simply do a little search on Amazon, you're going to come across titles such as posthumanism, the non-human turn, new materialism, speculative realism, object-oriented ontology, the effective turn, you name it. And the basic premise of these otherwise very different projects is a very simple one: humanism was. So, in other words, what unifies all these different perspectives is we have to begin from a very different place. But if we go back, and I think we already heard two of our speakers talk about this as well, if we go back just two generations ago, we see a very different landscape. From the Frankfurt School to the British historian, labor historians, from Arendt to Sartre to Merleau-Ponty, everybody and their mama is a humanist. Why and how all this begins to change, especially in the 60s, of course, is a very complex question, and as you saw, has already been addressed in part. It certainly has to do with the legacy, the aftermath of two wars, world wars, has to do with the rising tide of anti-colonial movements, certainly with discourses of suspicion, such as structuralism, psychoanalysis, phenomenology. But it also has to do with very particular interventions, as I'm sure we know, specifically in French theory of the 60s. This is the time when, of course, we have Foucault with his famous image of the face of man to be erased on the edges of the ocean at the end of The Order of Things. And of course, we have Althusser, his very famous claim that Marxism can only be a theoretical anti-humanism. Everything else is poor theory or, at worst, ideology, which he associates with, you know, a post-Stalinist Stalinism in a way. At the time when Althusser and Foucault made these statements, they are a minority position, certainly outside of France, but even in France. But in the years and decades to come, they become a sort of new theoretical normal. So in Althusser's footsteps, at some point I decided to kind of draw a little diagram of this. Of course, non-exhaustive, because you can put so many other people, I don't even have enough space. But in the years and decades to come, basically you have this transition from anti-humanism to maybe something like post-humanism today, with people like Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, Derrida, Stiegler, Praidotti, Butler, Zizek, Negri, you name it, far away. Again, huge differences between them. But the point of departure is humanism was, like I said. Second, however, the history of Althusser's text is also a very interesting one. Because Althusser's text was a response to a call for papers, which was issued by, at some point, of course, this German expat, Frankfurt School member at Front, who was trying to put together an anthology on socialist humanism. Yeah, that's when it came out in 65. The anthology was published in 65. And it was one of these efforts to bridge the gap between East and West. About a third of the contributors of the anthology were Eastern European Marxists, Eastern and Central European Marxists. There was also, I think, Leopold Senghor, one African, if I'm not mistaken. But of course, what wasn't part of the anthology was Althusser's text, because Althusser said Marxism is a theoretical anti-humanist. So Fromm said, no, we cannot really have you there. Althusser would publish his text. It would come out, I think, in different versions, different places, but of course it's part of For Marx, which also comes out in 65, I believe, and of course gave rise to the famous or infamous humanist controversy around his work at the time. But it would also signify the beginning of one of the major splits between sort of critical theory east and west of the Iron Curtain. In the West, we have the transition to anti-impulse humanism, but in Eastern Europe, and here's another little map, Marxist humanism in particular continues to be the name of the game through the course of the Cold War. This is the case in Hungary with the Budapest School, the Lukács students, some of whom actually, maybe in a different incarnation, seem to also have been here at this conference. This is the case in Poland with Kolakowski before he discovered liberalism was such a wonderful thing. Certainly the case in Czechoslovakia with Kaliuda, Kosik, Ivan Svitak, and in former Yugoslavia very centrally through the course of the Cold War. So a major theoretical reference point during the period between the early 50s and maybe early 90s. But last but not least, there's another humanist controversy, another bifurcation that takes place in relation to the language of the human. And it precedes Althusser's claim by maybe about 10, 15 years. Its chief protagonists are, we'll get to that in a minute, Caribbean intellectuals living in France, very centrally MSSA and France Fanon. Central texts include Discourse on Colonialism and basically anything you can read by Fanon. But the point of departure here is not a return to the young Marx as supposedly offering something better than Marx after the epistemic break. The reference point is the lived experience and legacy of colonialism. So again, if we point to a little diagram, you can see some of the people here. C.L.R. James, of course, is a little more ambiguous and has a different history, but certainly Césaire Fanon. We have the post-humanist term with people like Stuart Hall, Edouard Glissant, Gilroy, David Scott, and others, of course. But what is interesting is that this tradition, unlike the Marxist humanist tradition in Eastern Europe, which basically ended, at least as a major sort of theoretical reference point with the end of the Cold War, Caribbean humanism continues to draw its champions, including people such as Nelson Molano Torres, a major Caribbean philosopher these days, Sylvia Winter, who is a fantastic, also intellectual social theorist from Jamaica. A couple of quotes here. Nelson Maldonado, who has been talking about the decolonial humanism from the Caribbean, argues that the European philosophers tend to be much more critical of the concept of man when they say the end of man, but not so much of the idea of European. And of course, with Sylvia Winter, who has argued quite recently, actually, that the struggle of the new millennium will be around the question of the human. She argues that that will also entail dismantling what she calls a Western bourgeoisie conception of the human man, which over-represents itself as if it were the human itself. So something important to keep in mind, which we're going to come back to. We have at least three different trajectories. There's the master narrative, as it has become, the shift from humanism to post-humanism in the West, which for many people is the only thing that is, right? And then we have the Eastern European tradition of Marxist humanism and the Caribbean of decolonial humanism, and possibly many others, but we don't have to talk about them. Now today I want to focus a little bit more on one of these Marxist humanist traditions in Eastern Europe, arguably the most radical and influential one, that informed Yugoslavia, which is mostly associated, even though it's not reducible to this, to the work of a group of philosophers from Belgrade and Zagreb mostly, who call themselves the Praxis School or the Praxis Circle. Yugoslavia is, I would imagine probably quite a few of us know, was a very special case among the former socialist republics. They broke with the Soviet Union in 1948, which not only set the ground for a very sort of experimental, interesting project, partially perhaps effective, only partially, in socialist self-management, but also opened the ground for a very sort of interesting, experimental, open, and relatively uncensored engagement with the tradition of Marxism. So by the 50s, you already have a very strong critique of dialectical materialism, Stalin's dialectical versions of dialectical materialism, and by the mid-60s, you have the production of a collectively sort of crafted and very rigorous Marxist humanist orientation, which called itself Praxis. I'm just going to stress three features of their work, being mindful of the time as well. To begin with, the name, why Praxis? Praxis first because they published a journal with that name in local Serbo-Croatian edition and in an international edition in European, you know, West European languages, which actually would survive the end of the group and later would become Constellations, the journal that still exists. But they also call themselves Praxis because of the centrality of the concept of Praxis, along with other key terms that I think were already mentioned from especially the Paris manuscripts of Marx, such as alienation, species being, and of course, humanism and the human. Unlike Althusser, who they knew actually quite well, they were reading his work, the Praxis philosophers didn't see a rupture between the young and the mature Marx. They argued, and actually probably convincingly in some ways, there was a continuity. Second, for many of them, there was a broad dialectical orientation to their work. A conception of society and history as dialectical totalities, which would be accessed best through philosophy as a totalizing discipline, unlike the sciences, which only give you fragmentary knowledge. This is Mihailo Markovic's formulation. But perhaps most important is the deployment of the deployment of Marxist humanism and the dialectic in their work, which would allow them to make a very important distinction between abstract and concrete criticism. So abstract criticism of alienation is alienated criticism. This is the sort of ahistorical sort of critique that thinks of no space, no concrete totality, just talks in very broad terms. By contrast, concrete criticism, and this is just a long quote, again from Markovic, locates alienation in your own society, in this case socialist society, identifies the appropriation of surplus value by the elites, the continued fetishism of commodities, the absence of self-management where it counts, and so on. In fact, in a really fine text, I think, by Golubka Zagorčić, who is one of the members of the group, she says that alienation is a problem only under socialism, because capitalism is premised on alienation. She says we can only identify it as a problem from within the perspective of a socialist society, concrete criticism, right? Which, of course, targeted also the Yugoslav scene. The activities of the group were seen as so subversive that by the mid-70s, Tito himself, Chairman Tito, would intervene and try to squash the movement quite successfully. By 75, this kind of fight would reach its apex. Praxis, the journal, the Serbo-Croatian version, would be shut down. The summer school they would have would also be shut down. And the culmination would be the firing of eight Belgrade philosophers, the Belgrade Eight. And it was a big deal. People like Chomsky were signing petitions, I think, all sorts of, Eddie Fromm, I believe, as well. It was a huge thing, right, in the West as well. But what happens next is no less interesting. And this is where my paper and my presentation and Zivka's, I think, speak to each other. What happens next, thank you, constitutes the dark secrets of Praxis, if you will. What is the dark secret of Praxis? Interesting things happened with them by the late 80s and early 90s. The Belgrade Eight, if you look at their subsequent history. Come the end of socialism, five of them become liberals. And they begin talking about capitalism with a human face. Right? It's no longer the Dubček. It's capitalism with a human face. Two of them flirt with nationalism for like a minute. And then you have Mihailo Marković, a professor from the University of Belgrade, probably maybe even the most sort of reputable or respected member of the group, who by the mid-90s becomes nothing less than the right-hand man of Slobodan Milosevic, the politician of Great Serbia, and one of the apologetic sort of, one of the apologets of pan-Serbian nationalism. He co-authors a very famous, infamous memorandum of the Serbian Academy of Science that calls for ethnic cleansing. And as late as the late 1990s, during the Kosovo campaign, when NATO was bombing Kosovo, Marković was still publishing articles, including in Praxis International, where he argued that the problem with the Albanian minority in former Yugoslavia, is that they are Muslim, not Christian. They tend to side with fascism historically, and he literally says it, they multiply too much, right? And apparently he never recanted. I remember reading a late interview with him from just before he died, and somebody asked him, okay, you used to be a socialist internationalist, now you're a pan-Serbian nationalist, isn't this a problem? He said, no, one is the extension of the other, right?
He said what?
One is the extension of the other. My socialist internationalism leads me to my Serbian sort of pan-nationalism. Now, of course, this is not to suggest, and I have to move very quickly because we don't have time, this is not to suggest that this was the position of most Praxis philosophers at the time. Many of them were critical of him, in public or in private. But I think it would be too simplistic to read his racist biopolitical turn as a simple outlier, like he went crazy at some point. In fact, it's difficult when you go through the archive of Praxis, the biggest school of Marxist humanism in Eastern Europe, not to see the colonial metaphors written large all over their texts. Here's a couple of those. This is the opening issue of Praxis, written by Predrag Vranitsky, where he juxtaposes the fetishism of primitive people at their low level of development to like full-blown civilized Europeans. Marković himself talks about how socialist struggles are rooted in struggles against the Ottoman Turks. So he makes that connection that Zivka also saw in Bulgaria. But I think this one is probably one of the better ones even, where a person basically identifies ethnocentrism as a sort of primitive and infantile mentality, which is sort of close to the logic of cannibalistic tribes. So any kind of ethnocentrism in a context of a federal, of course, a republic such as Yugoslavia is close to cannibalism. So do I have some time to make a few quick conclusions?
Yeah.
Okay. So what are some of the lessons from this Praxis fiasco for us today, at least in the context of our panel? And again, I'm going to move really quickly for the limits of time. To begin with, and to be bluntly honest, I think it's very unrealistic to expect the resurrection of any kind of Marxist humanism in Eastern Europe at this point. This doesn't strike me as the discourse anymore. Under state socialism, it opened up really important spaces for feminist struggles, for immanent critique of the state, which is what Praxis were doing, an immanent critique of state socialism, right? But I think a lot of these spaces seem to be closed for reasons that extend way beyond the theoretical, of course. But at the same time, I'm not crazy hell-bent to insist on this. I don't think the one or two words in the party program determine the future at this point. I think people use whatever they want to use. What is more important to me that the kind of label we're going to attach to radical theory in Eastern Europe is the alternative practices, institutions, and counter-hegemonic sense, counter-hegemonic common sense that has to be created as a collective project that obviously doesn't just include intellectuals, and probably doesn't even include mostly intellectuals. In former Yugoslavia, the biggest stumbling block for the Praxis philosophers was the problem of federalism, the multicultural composition of the Yugoslav Federation. The Marxist humanist way of dealing with this problem was to basically make it, shove it under the rug, and to try to make disappear the ethnic and cultural alterity in the name of, very similar to here, class homogeneity and a universalistic humanism that very easily slid into racism. And the only way to avoid repeating this move is to do what the Praxis philosophers refused to do, to start looking, reading, learning from other people as well, especially, I think, people from the global south. I don't have the time to go into the decolonial humanism from the Caribbean, but I think there are important lessons to be learned from there. As long as we're just reading the same folks, going back to the early Marx, I don't think it's necessarily going to cut it. We have to look elsewhere, including outside of the West. And I want to finish here with the sort of a rephrasing of the wonderful epigraph to C.L.R. James's book on cricket, Beyond the Boundary, where he asks at the beginning, you might remember, what do they know of cricket? Who only cricket know? This is how I like to think about Marxist humanism. What do we know of Marxist humanism if we only Marxist humanism know? Thank you very much. Let me just open terms as well. Oh, this is the escape, correct? Thank you very much.
How is that connected to the projector?
Just make it bigger? Yep.
There's longer versions of each of them in this book that came out, Pluto. Okay, so I want to begin with Althusser because, frankly, for comments like this, I mean, I think there's probably way more support for Althusser than the kinds of perspectives I'm going to be working with. So, I mean, we could say a lot about Althusser, but I just want to say this theoretical anti-humanism, people, I think, skip over that. It's a very precise phrase, and he's not saying there that there's just a break between the young and the older Marx, which he regards as a almost total break, but that Marx's own program after 1844 was theoretical anti-humanism, that was what the philosophical ground. I think there's no evidence for that. Marx. I mean, he doesn't have a he drops the explicit references to humanism, but certainly alienation, its close relative of alienation and de-alienation continues all through, as we know. But then the later Althusser, of course, starts, in terms of humanism, starts to say, like in the preface to Capital, that he writes, I think, around 1970, he says that really chapter one of Capital has a lot of problems too, especially the fetishism section. He recommends skipping that, starting with the historical thing, because you get confused if you read Marx in the dialectical order you wanted us to. So there, if you get to that point where you say, well, Capital, which in the French edition goes all the way to 1875, 7 years before his, 8 years before his death, Marx is still working on. Then he says, well, really, the notes on Adolf Wagner, I believe that's 1882, one year before his death. That's where Marx finally gets rid of all this stuff and becomes Marxist. Well, if that's the case, then we're already Foucault, because what Foucault says, Foucault in a sense agrees with what I'm going to say, which is that Marx is a humanist and a Hegelian, and that's what's wrong with Marx. So, okay. Now, I think, and Barbara alluded to this as well, that humanism helps us to think about what we're for rather than what we're just against, because the left continues to get trapped in this thing. I mean, my hometown now, Los Angeles, the April 7th demonstration, I have a picture I can show you of it, against the bombing of Syria with the Answer Coalition, it had a giant portrait of Bashar Assad at the front of the demonstration. Because we're against Trump and against US imperialism, we don't trouble ourselves enough over what we're for. We make alliances, we, not people in this room, but the broad left. So I think humanism, Marxism at a theoretical level, helps us to avoid the kind of mentality that would lead us into that kind of. And there are a lot of versions of it, and I'm saying socialist humanism too, although in the book they change the title to Marxist humanism. But I have Sartre in there, who during the period that I think is most interesting, had not declared itself Marxist. So of course, the Sartrean version of radical humanism is very subjectivist, and you know, reacting against the determinism of all kinds of philosophies, including Stalinism. So this is from the 1846 lecture. The human being's progressive subjective life is not a cauliflower. So anti-determinist, and then the other thing, it differentiates itself from liberal humanism, which in France, one Republican humanism of the early 20th century, because those people couldn't successfully resist fascism. Not that most of them didn't try to, but they weren't able. He says that to the Republican humanist, it's just like everything is a dialogue and an argument, and they don't know what a real enemy is that you have to really combat. So coming out of that spirit of the resistance, although he didn't actually participate in the resistance, but I don't want to get into that. How Ernst Jünger helped him get his book published. That's a whole thing. I can't blame him. So radical subjectivism is a problem. Abstract universalism is also a problem. He writes a preface to this Orphée Noir. It's an infamous piece where he says, which Fanon later attacks, where he says, the Negro has to start thinking of himself after a while, not just as a Negro, but not in racial terms, but in class terms. And that'll be a higher level of consciousness if the Negro starts to do that. So there's a danger of abstract universality. And of course, in the Hegelian terms, what we're talking about is a night in which all cows are black, which is Hegel's criticism of Schelling, who he doesn't name. And there's that letter from Schelling saying, rumors tell me that I'm the one you're talking about. We were friends, and please tell me this is not the case. And Hegel never answers. Okay, so Erich Fromm comes from a different tradition, obviously, than Sartre, hated Sartre. He doesn't see Marx as a materialist, and many of the Marxist humanists and socialist humanists thought that Marx was partially an idealist. There's lines in 1844 that suggest that. But the whole point here is that what Marx's concept of socialism would be that we'd not be bound to our economic needs in kind of the constraining way that we are under capitalism. And of course, as several people have mentioned, well, Marx's concept of man, at least in English, I mean, that really put the young Marx on the map. That was 1961. I have an essay, it's in my book a little bit, I can't mention it, but the Cold War liberals all attacked Fromm. I mean, this was the most prominent mention of Marx that had probably occurred in over a decade in the United States. I mean, it's in a positive way. And they all attacked him, Sidney Hook, Daniel Bell, on and on. The young Richard Bernstein calls it almost totalitarian, the arguments that Fromm is making. Okay, he's getting a sense, because Fromm is like dismissed too often as merely like a liberal. I think at this conference he'd probably be one of the least popular Marxists. But this is a very interesting point in the letter about Rosa Luxemburg, the sensitivity to gender, where he says, Rosa Luxemburg receded in the Marxist movement, and even at the time, of course, she was very prominent in German Marxism, among the revolutionary Marxists. Was there a real camaraderie between her and Lenin and Trotsky, or was gender a barrier there? And what that could have meant if at the time she was more recognized. Okay, weak points. It gets very eclectic, and when I go to Fromm conferences, people get mad at me for saying this. But, I mean, Fromm, and this is what Hook and those people attack him for. Well, Marx is really, he's a humanist, he's also like a Zen Buddhist, it's also prophetic messianism in the Judeo-Christian tradition. He's really an existentialist also, which was very popular at that time. So that the preface, the long preface he writes to Hayden Porter Fisher, there's some really great moments in it, but it has this kind of thing. And then also an abstract character, and this is what, you know, this is the liberal side of Fromm. And Fromm, in 68, Fromm is working in the Gene McCarthy movement. But that doesn't mean he's like, I mean, he's supporting the student left at the same time. And he's the main speaker at the counter-commencement of the students at Columbia in 68, where he blasts the administration, their police brutality. But there is that abstract character to Fromm's humanism. Okay, here's someone who's definitely not abstract in that sense, which is Franz Fanon. So, as Nicolai was talking about, attacks on European humanism, but it's somewhat along the line, I mean, it's somewhat along the lines of what Gandhi once said, Western civilization, like, that sounds like a great idea. I'd like to see that. So this is the line from Our Wretch of the Earth, explicit humanism. This is forgotten in a lot of the discussions today, or really always about Fanon, because the chapter on violence in Wretch of the Earth was what really grabbed everybody, including, of course, the Black Panthers at that time. I want to say one more thing, though, Fanon, which is in Fanon, I mean, following, I guess, Hegel, who he had studied, the universal has to particularize or concretize itself in Hegel. There's a strong opposition to abstract universals, that neither which all cows are black and so forth. So with Fanon, too, he has this line at the end of Wretch of the Earth where he says, national consciousness, which is not nationalism, because it's deeper and broader and more humanistic, is the only thing that will give us an international dimension. Well, I mean, it's that dialectical trickery, I guess, going on there. Because what he's saying is that for an African society that's been so oppressed and also its whole culture and civilization denied, not just by the West, but as we saw by the East as well, that self-recognition, self-determination, maybe even a period of, in other words, national independence, in order to then later on have the community of peoples across national lines. So that's Fanon's dialectic. Okay, the last one I want to, I have Karol Kosik, one of the best East European Marxists in there, who kind of was preserved in ICE or something because he stayed in Czechoslovakia. It was very repressive, so he wrote some really good stuff. in the early 60s, and then he never wrote that much more. Although what he said about Kosovo is somewhat problematic, that he didn't go the full length of somebody like Markovitch. Okay, but the last one I talk about is my mentor, Radha Nevskaya. So in a certain sense, she's appropriating a lot from Fanon and Kosick. I mean, she's one of the people that discusses them philosophically fairly early on. But I can't do that whole thing here, so I want to just focus on her book, Marxism and Freedom. Her first book, this is the one where the first English translation of major parts of the 1844 manuscripts appeared in 1958. And this is something that's true of Fromm as well. People, you know, Fromm is accused of wanting to separate in the opposite direction, the young Marx and the older Marx, you know, that he loved the young Marx. It's true he wrote about the young Marx and published that. But there's no textual evidence I've ever seen where Fromm said the young Marx is better than the old Marx. Some liberals apparently were saying that. I'm thinking of like Robert Tucker, but I can never find that. Anyone can? I'd like to see that. But I know where that started, I'm pretty sure, which is Jean-Paul Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre, in the 40s, Materialism and Revolution, I think it's called, he says that Marx was really great through 1844 until the unfortunate meeting with Engels, the face rencontre. And of course, Marx, as Engels tells us, he'd already written the 1844 manuscript by that time. And Marx gave to me orally the whole thing that he later developed. So that's where that comes from, which people don't realize. Okay. So one of the things Dunayevskaya wants to do is the humanism and dialectic of Capital, not just 1844, arguing for a somewhat subjectivist interpretation of volume one of Capital, in the sense that the problem of the worker, including the resistance of the worker over the working day and so forth, you can't understand the book without that. But it's also, she's also interested in bringing it up to the present, and unlike what a lot of people do nowadays, which is to say kind of everyone is a worker, except the 1%. And this follows from C.L.R. James and Grace Lee, that Boggs, they work together, and they're already doing this in the 40s. It's simpler. It's just that there are other forces of revolution besides the working class. That it's not the new social movement, but what was later called the new social movement. They're already saying that in like 1947 or so, but they're saying it's alongside labor and more of the rank and file labor than the labor bureaucracy, which was already operating at that time as well. So, I mean, I fleshes out a lot more in my essay, but some forms of socialist and Marxist humanism tended toward the abstract universal. My former friend Mihailo, I mean, I knew him in the 80s. He helped my academic career a little bit in the early 80s. The abstract universal, I mean, this very, very abstract notion of man, humanism, so on, that we can't really think about these small things like ethnicity, then it turns out we can, because it's a little like that French secular universalism, where then it hides, I mean, all this ethnocentric stuff. And this is just an anecdote, but he was at my house in 1986, and I just made this joke about, well, according to the history I had in high school, it's you guys' fault that World War I started. It seems like a joke. It's more complicated how World War I started, and we're Marxists, right? But he just like kind of clenched a little bit and changed the subject. I remember that now, but anyway, my argument is that Fanon and Dunayevskaya, because they're willing to talk about ethnicity and race and so forth, and very much so in colonialism, definitely with Fanon, both of them, that it's a humanism that allows room for the particular. And Fromm and Sartre, who are the best known, I guess along with E.P. Thompson, but Fromm and Sartre are the focus on, their humanism has a more abstract character, although I think it's still very worthwhile looking at. But this East European version of it is very troubling. And I would think of it more in terms of there's some problems in the beginning, but I would see it more as a dialectical transformation into opposite. You know, we had the German Social Democratic Party of 1902 was making all these resolutions against war and so on, and then when the war came, I see it more in those terms, but that doesn't mean the seeds of it aren't present, but is that the dominant aspect in the earlier period? I'm less sure of that. But you can see it. If you go back and look at Ivan Svitak, one of the great spokespersons of the 68 in Prague, there's some lines in there that say, you know, where Europe, Russia is Asia, you get some of that kind of
check.
Let's end here. Sorry, oh, my word. Sorry.
That was perfect. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.